This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what's next for Iraq now that the so-called Islamic State has suffered military defeat in Mosul? Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. The battle for Mosul is over, but the war against the so-called Islamic State, or Daesh, as it's known in Arabic, is far from over. Iraqi armed forces routed Daesh from Mosul in early July. The victory, which marked the end of a bloody campaign that lasted nearly 9 months, left much of Iraq's second largest city in ruins, killed thousands of people, and displaced nearly a million more. Daesh overran the historic city in 2014. But enormous economic and security challenges remain, such as the task of rebuilding and resettling Mosul and cleaning up the last remaining pockets of Islamic State resistance. Regional analysts agree that driving most of ISIS or Daesh forces out of Mosul is an important victory at the tactical level, according to Anthony Cordesman, strategy chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. The fight in Mosul is still a work in progress, but he thinks Iraq is close enough to driving Daesh fully out of the city, which shows Iraqi forces have steadily improved over time. However, there is the issue of the longer-term strategies of reconstruction and political integration. Nearly every building on the western side of Mosul was completely destroyed. The lack of water, electricity, and other basic services are keeping thousands of displaced residents from returning. Well, with us to discuss the challenges ahead in rebuilding Mosul, preventing Daesh and other extremists from regrouping, and the longer-term strategy of stabilizing Iraq, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Jennifer Caffarella is a former Syria analyst and lead intelligence planner at the Institute for the Study of War, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. And Daniel Serwer, he's a scholar at the Middle East Institute and professor and director of the Conflict Management Program at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program. Well, Daniel Serwer, let me begin with you and talk about the rout of ISIS from Mosul occurred earlier this month. It's an important victory, but it's still insufficient. What is your take on the significance of this event?
I think it is significant. It demonstrated an enormous increase in capacity on the part of the Iraqi security forces, and it was a very difficult fight, no question about it. But what lies ahead is much more difficult. And what lies ahead is an effort to reintegrate politically the population of Mosul, get it back to its homes, not just physically, but also get them participating in the political life of Iraq, and then ensuring that ISIS can't come back. It is defeated in the sense that its military formations have been scattered, it's been deprived of territory, but it will remain as an underground force, especially outside the city, but also inside the city. In fact, the reason it took over Mosul so quickly was that it was already embedded inside the city.
Indeed, and that leads me to turn now to Jennifer Caffarella for your take on the victory in Mosul and the very important challenges ahead that Daniel outlined of politically integrating the population, rebuilding the city physically, of preventing ISIS from returning, and also combating the ideology or the conditions, political and economic and otherwise, that led to their taking of the city.
Absolutely. So I do agree that actually the task ahead of the Iraqi state and the anti-ISIS coalition is actually in many ways more difficult than the task thus far completed. The defeat of ISIS inside of Mosul is an important win for Iraq's Prime Minister Abadi and for the Iraqi security forces in demonstrating their commitment to defeating this enemy and restoring the security that the Iraqi people deserve. However, ISIS as a military organization is far from defeated fully in Iraq. The military defines defeat as the loss of the will and or capability to continue to fight, and ISIS still has both. ISIS actually is still in control of additional cities in Iraq, to include the city of Tel Afar, west of Mosul, which is where anti-ISIS clearing operations appear to be going next. So removing ISIS from additional cities in Iraq is still a very large military task. Far less attention and resources have gone into actually changing the political situation in Iraq to actually ensure that the populations we have liberated from ISIS control will trust the Iraqi state to guarantee their security moving forward. And the unfortunate reality is the military success achieved against ISIS thus far has in part been dependent on Iran's involvement in this war and the involvement of Iranian proxy forces. And that Iranian involvement is actually a key political issue for reconciling the Sunni populations that had been living under ISIS back to the Iraqi government. So certainly a long way to go from here.
Turning back to you, Daniel Serwer, and picking up on what Jennifer said about Iran's involvement, proxy militias that are sponsored by Iran, the Shia militias, certainly they are as much of an irritant to the Sunni population as perhaps was the so-called Islamic State or Daesh. How optimistic are you, or perhaps pessimistic, about the ability to win these Sunni populations over? Is the Iraqi state, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, doing anything to assuage the concerns of the Sunni population who would be returning to Mosul regarding the Iranian influence?
My understanding is that the popular mobilization forces, the Hashid al-Shaabi, were not in the vanguard of the taking of the center of the city, and that was a wise political decision on the part of the Iraqi security forces and Prime Minister al-Abadi. That said, they clearly were important in the overall fight. And the fact that they weren't in the vanguard doesn't change the fact that they played a role, and it's unclear what role they intend to play in the future. We're seeing a lot of reports of atrocities against supposed ISIS fighters in Mosul. We're seeing a lot of videos. We're seeing a lot of assertions that there are gross human rights violations, crimes against humanity. And that doesn't help the situation. If you're Sunni and not ISIS, watching people who are supposedly ISIS be killed at random, pretty much, by Iraqi security forces is not going to win you over the loyalty to the Iraqi state. So that's a big issue. Abadi, in many respects, is the very best you're going to get in Iraq for reaching out to the Sunni population. He is nowhere near as sectarian in his language, in his behavior, as their former Prime Minister Maliki was. But at the same time, he owes an enormous debt to the popular mobilization forces. He has to speak favorably about them. He repeatedly says that they've been incorporated into the Iraqi security forces, which is formally correct, but still raises a lot of questions about how sectarian those forces really are. So I think Abadi has his work cut out for him in convincing Sunnis that the peace is one that they can live with.
Jennifer Caffarella, he has his work cut out for him, that is Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, who probably has very good intentions and would very much like to reach out to the Sunni population, but he has been dependent on these so-called popular mobilization forces, the Shia militias, and then Iranian-backed forces. So how optimistic are you going forward that somehow the Sunni population will be assuaged, will be integrated in the economy and in politics in Mosul and also in Iraq writ large?
Absolutely. So I do agree that Haider al-Abadi is in many respects the man for the job. He understands the problem in its true form. He is committed to addressing some of these core concerns. However, the question right now is whether he can. He has increasingly been able to acquire regional support from Sunni Arab states, which is important, and that does help boost his credibility as a figure that is willing and perhaps able to reach out to Sunni communities locally in Iraq. But look, Haider al-Abadi tried multiple times to get legislation through the Iraqi parliament and to make political concessions to Sunni parties in order to actually concretely address some of these grievances. And he was unable to do so because of the competition that he faced and because of the effectiveness of Iranian clients actually within the Iraqi political sphere, in addition to the importance, as was mentioned, of the Iranian-backed elements within the Hashid al-Shaabi, within that popular mobilization force in a military sense. So Abadi really faces both military and political constraints that simply threaten to mitigate his ability to make good on perhaps the reforms that he intends to achieve.
Quick clarification from you. Are there actual Iranian troops in Iraq or just Iranian-backed Shia militias?
Well, that's actually a good question. So from open source, it's always difficult to confirm Iranian deployments. However, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Quds Force has certainly been highly active in Iraq. The best example of this is that you often see pictures of the Quds Force commander Qasem Soleimani touring the battlefield and meeting with Iranian proxy forces on the ground. So the Iranians are certainly there, and that's widely known.
Would you agree,
yes,
Daniel?
Yes, I agree entirely. They are there. It's one of these peculiar situations where the Americans and the Iranians have a common enemy in ISIS and are de facto fighting together against it, even if there's no coordination or collaboration.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Jennifer Caffarella. She's lead intelligence planner at the Institute for the Study of War, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. And Daniel Serwer, from whom you just heard, he's professor and director of the Conflict Management Program at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And we are discussing the liberation of Mosul from the so-called Islamic State or Daesh and the challenges ahead in rebuilding the historic city and stabilizing Iraq. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Johnson Titus. He's a loyal listener from Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Also, please fill out a brief online survey and tell us what you think of Encounter. You can find the survey on our Facebook page at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. We're back to our program about Iraq and back to you, Daniel Serwer, to talk specifically about reconstructing and stabilizing Mosul. We note that more than 900,000 Iraqis fled the city, with more than 700,000 yet to return. The budget the UN has this year has not really been fully funded for this. Talk about the big challenges and the importance of rebuilding as soon as possible.
The biggest challenge in the immediate aftermath of a military victory like this is to preserve security. And that will have to be the responsibility of the Iraqi security forces. As much as possible, I hope, the army and not the Hashid al-Shaabi. Once you've settled things down and have some modicum of security, you need to begin to think about governance and reviving the economy. And, you know, many people think there is a kind of golden hour after something like this in which you can achieve much more than you would normally be able to achieve. People have been displaced. If you can move the rubble out of the way, you can do all sorts of reconstruction relatively easily. There is an opportunity here. I have not seen plans for Mosul that convince me that that golden hour will be taken advantage of. I think things did go relatively well in Tikrit, but Tikrit is a much smaller place than Mosul, and a place where there were local people able and willing to help handle things. The situation in Mosul is much more complicated because Mosul is a multi-ethnic city. It's not only Sunni Arab, it has Kurds and Christians and lots of other people live there as well. And it's going to be much more complicated to put together a kind of political governance operation that can take on responsibility for the very important economic and social issues that will arise.
Turning to you, Jennifer, for your take on that, we're at a very critical moment, a turning point, a point at which both Iraq, the region, and the international community would want to capitalize upon. Are we going to be able to do that? Is there enough money, political will, to capitalize on this and to address the challenges that Daniel outlined?
I definitely share Daniel's concerns about, A, the planning for a post-liberation reconstruction of Mosul, which does not actually appear to have been robust enough, but also the very real security challenge that remains. Securing a destroyed city while internally displaced persons are returning to destroyed homes is a very difficult task. ISIS has likely left sleeper cells and latent capabilities inside of Mosul that ISIS will use in precisely an effort to disrupt that security and to continue to fuel doubt in the minds of the local population about whether the Iraqi state can be trusted. This is a model that we've seen ISIS do in other recaptured cities where ISIS attacks are now actually increasingly frequent. Ramadi is a very good example. This is an enemy that is very far from dead, and yet the Iraqi security forces have been exhausted in the Mosul operation, precisely because the Hashid al-Shaabi forces are not actually good enough to do the kind of urban warfare that the Iraqi security forces just won inside of Mosul. But what that means is that the security force in recaptured areas is often increasingly dependent on the Hashid al-Shaabi, not because Prime Minister Abadi necessarily intends for those forces to be the security force, but simply because the elite elements of the Iraqi security forces are exhausted. Now, what that means is that ISIS also has the opportunity not just to exploit perceived grievances of the Sunni population at the hands of the Hashid al-Shaabi, but the coordination between popular mobilization units and the Iraqi security forces is difficult. And those seams are precisely the kind of vulnerability that ISIS is able to exploit. So I'm concerned that we need to not only focus on the extraordinary reconstruction cost and effort, which is at least $1 billion, I've heard, for restoring Mosul City alone to basic functionality of services. The United States, the anti-ISIS coalition more broadly, and certainly Prime Minister Abadi need actually to consider all of these elements and how they intersect, how the rebuilding and security dynamics intersect.
Daniel Serwer, it seems to me that the United States has an important role to play. The United States wants to combat the so-called Islamic State, Daesh. It wants to see a strong and stable Iraq for that reason and for just stability in general. What is the role for the United States right now in the Trump administration? Do you see them playing a strong role in trying to secure Iraq and Mosul right now?
I think when it comes to the military effort against the Islamic State, there's no question about the commitment both of the previous administration and the current administration. But the current administration has made it absolutely clear that it does not want to be involved in the reconstruction process, in the political reconciliation process, or any of that stuff. In fact, my understanding is that they've prohibited discussion of it. This raises difficult issues because, of course, without the American push, I'm not sure that Abadi has the wherewithal, the political wherewithal, as Jennifer suggests, to get the necessary things done, not only in the Iraqi parliament, but also in the governance of Mosul itself. Look, we certainly don't have the role in Mosul that we had in Iraq when we invaded it and occupied it. That's absolutely clear. We cannot do the things we tried to do then. We spent a colossal amount of money. A lot of it was wasted. And no one would suggest that we take on all those responsibilities. But I think there is a political and diplomatic role for the United States in pushing things in Iraq in the right direction and in trying to ensure that international community resources are made available from the World Bank, from the IMF, from UNDP, from all these other organizations. And I'm not convinced the Trump administration understands that role or cares to play that role. And that is very concerning.
Jennifer, what's your take on the U.S. role here in perhaps helping to push forward political reconciliation? Do you agree with Daniel Serwer that you're not actually seeing that will to do so? And then that would lead us to ask why, because if we leave that vacuum, then the Iranians will continue to exert their influence and hegemony, which certainly is not in the interest of the U.S. government or the Trump administration. How do you square that?
Yeah, I do agree. The U.S. has largely actually treated Iraqi politics as an Iraqi problem in the context of the anti-ISIS fight. That actually began under President Obama, who took a very limited approach to engagement, of course, in the Middle East after ISIS's rise, defined the primary American interest in the region as the defeat of ISIS alone, and subordinated all other considerations, including containing the Iranians, to focusing first and foremost on the military lines of effort against ISIS. The Trump administration has simply continued that policy and, in fact, even drifted more towards a hands-off approach for the United States in the political realm. So a very good example of this is how often did Secretary of State Kerry under President Obama visit Iraq?
Exactly.
Secretary Tillerson has not gone. So there is not this kind of top-level political effort to shore up, actually, Abadi's role or to enable him to contain or counter the Iranian influence. It's just not there, which means, from my perspective, we're actually going to lose this war against ISIS because we've created a quote-unquote post-ISIS environment where Iran is thriving, which will alienate people, and we're going to be on this merry-go-round, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future until or unless we can actually break this cycle.
Interesting. And as we close, very briefly, back to you, Daniel Serwer. Talk about briefly the relationship between Iraq's stability and Syria. Some say, how can Iraq be stable if Syria is still in turmoil? And we know that ISIS is, although it's losing territory in Raqqa, it's still there. And we note that President Trump just recently ended the CIA's covert program to arm and train moderate Syrian rebels battling the government, that is, of Bashar al-Assad, who, of course, is a major obstacle to peace and stability, who actually fuels the rise of ISIS. We have a difficult situation.
Syria is not stabilized and will not be stabilized anytime soon. It'll be fragmented. There will be ISIS even after the defeat in Raqqa. The fact of the matter is that Syria will remain a haven for the Islamic State as long, frankly, as Bashar al-Assad is in power, because he enables and encourages the Sunni population to support whoever will fight for their interests. So I think we're nowhere near the end of this war in Syria and in Iraq, and we do not appear to have the will to bring it to a successful political conclusion.
The last word to you, Jennifer, on the relationship between Iraq's stability and Syria.
Yeah, America's strategy in Syria has been confused from the get-go and is increasingly actually amounting to a surrender to the pro-Assad coalition of Russia, Iran, and Bashar al-Assad himself. Look, the core actual problem underlying ISIS and jihadism in this theater more broadly is that Sunni populations in both Iraq and Syria felt persecuted by their government, attempted to rise up and protest and achieve reforms in both Iraq and Syria, were met with violence by the Nour al-Maliki government in Iraq and, of course, by Bashar al-Assad, and had nobody else to turn to. These populations still perceive the Iraqi government and certainly the Syrian government as manifestations of a persecution against them as the population. The United States has not fixed that core problem. We've taken all sorts of terrain from ISIS. We've destroyed cities while doing so, but we haven't actually addressed the core causes for the ISIS phenomenon in the first place. What that means is that ISIS will have long-term staying power and the ability to regenerate. It also means that on the Syrian side of the border, America's strategy is playing directly into the hands of al-Qaeda, which doesn't get talked about a lot in Washington, but is the preeminent military force within the opposition fighting against Bashar al-Assad. And al-Qaeda is even more dangerous because al-Qaeda is perceived in many respects to have the moral high ground, because al-Qaeda has been fighting against the war criminal regime while the United States has been ignoring it or increasingly submitting to it. That's an incredibly dangerous problem because ISIS was not actually perceived to have the moral high ground in that same way. What that means is that the United States faces a very formidable jihadist threat still inside of Syria, and we need to be very concerned, actually, that al-Qaeda will manage to grow in Iraq even as ISIS is defeated, and that the United States could actually face an even more difficult Mosul battle in the future if we do not actually find a way to fix these fundamental problems and to generate the American willpower to see it through.
On that ominous note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Jennifer Caffarella. She's lead intelligence planner at the Institute for the Study of War, and Daniel Serwer, professor and director of the Conflict Management Program at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Morgan Mendenhall for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.